Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. You're watching Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Malaysia's entry into the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, or better known by its acronym CPTPP, has now come into force. This 2 months after the previous government had ratified the trade pact on the 30th of September. It also comes amid a campaign by a collective of economists, NGOs and trade unions calling for Malaysia's withdrawal from the ratified agreement before it comes into force. But now that it already has, what happens next? My first guest tonight is Chee Yok Ling. She is director of the International Research and Advocacy Organization, Third World Network. Yok Ling, thank you for joining me today. I understand Third World Network was one of the signatories of the petition to call for the withdrawal from the CPTPP. Can you begin our conversation tonight by maybe sharing a little bit about the contentions, what the contentions are over the ratification of the CPTPP?
Thank you, Melissa. It's great to be back, and thank you for this opportunity. Yes, well, the CPTPP, rather mouthful of an agreement, has entered into force, and it is a long haul for us because in Third World Network, we've had a team of economists and lawyers, including from outside our organization, that have done a very detailed analysis of the CPTPP provisions. We're talking about more than almost 2,000 pages and 30 chapters. So it is very comprehensive, for sure, and has got tremendous impact on all aspects of our economy and society.
Okay, so I know that there are always trade-offs in any kind of trade pact, but most people think that the CPTPP is about greater economic growth, about freer trade. We had that cost-benefit analysis that was done to, you know, show that, well, actually Malaysia will benefit from trade, will increase, our trade will increase. Are you saying that you don't see the opportunities outweighing the trade-offs?
Yeah, I think really, you know, Melissa, the details are very important. I think we see a lot of general statements being made. Yeah, for example, even the second cost-benefit analysis that was done, commissioned by MITI, yeah, recently, actually, if you really look at even that cost-benefit analysis, it raises quite a lot of concerns. For example, you know, one of the biggest benefits is supposed to be more increased exports, yeah, for our Malaysian exporters. But our study that we did, which we asked an economist in the United Nations in UNCTAD, using a World Bank methodology, and what Dr. Banga did was to take all the 11 countries, and then later on she also did it for China and UK, if they join, looking at all their tariff lines, their import duties, yeah, this is a really detailed methodology. And they found that we will, yes, increase some exports, but we will actually import even more than we will export under CPTPP. Now, if you look at the cost-benefit analysis that's done by MITI, if you look at the details, it actually says, yes, we will have increased exports, but we will also have increased imports, which means that overall, what we call the trade balance will actually go down. So, but the way it's presented is rather misleading because it shows that, yes, we will have overall a trade surplus, but that will actually go down over the years by 2030 in their own study. So we will import more than we will export. Why? Because under this agreement, Malaysia will remove, you know, all the import duties and tariffs, 100% removal to zero for all products. Right now, already we are exporting a lot to many of the countries in the CPTPP. If you look at within ASEAN or Australia, New Zealand, Japan, we have other agreements with them, and they're already very open. So we're already exporting a lot, and we do very well as an exporting country. So if we can't export more, what are the real reasons? If we can't export more to Peru or Chile or Mexico until today, is it because you have no CPTPP or trade agreement, or is it because there are real, you know, other problems, other barriers? And I think that is a question that we have raised again and again.
But the non-trade, non-tariff barriers you're referring to, Yok Ling, there are provisions under the CPTPP that address non-tariff barriers as well. I mean, isn't that one of the ways to increase. So we're not talking about,
again, yeah. Again, let's go down and look at details, right? Because when we say non-tariff measures, we call them barriers, they are everything except the numbers of the sort of barriers in terms of taxes, right? Or tariffs. So you look at that, it can be anything. For example, if you look at, now one of the chapters that is in this, there are 30 chapters, yeah? And one of the chapters is on government procurement. Now, this means that once you join and you're part of the CPTPP, you have to open up your government procurement contracts to all the members of the CPTPP, all the companies from there, unless you have put some carve-outs and safeguards, right? You can negotiate that. So let's take Japan. Japan is almost like, their government procurement is almost completely liberalized, right? So in theory, without the CPTPP, Malaysian contractors and developers can go and bid for contracts in Japan. Why hasn't it happened? It's because there are other non-tariff or this is not tariff, we're talking here about, what is the reason? Is it because it's in Japanese? Or is it because there are other ways? Because in theory, you can go in and bid, but why do we not get it? Or maybe we're not competitive. So that means, so there are these issues. Or you want to go into a South American country, they may have very little, barriers to government procurement tenders for us to participate as a foreign company, but maybe it's all in Spanish. So these are the issues that we have to look into. And then many health, food regulations, exist. So we talked to some of our small exporters, right? Because most exporters are big guys. So one of the things we hear is, SMEs will be able to export a lot more under the CPTPP. It's a very big struggle because, Malaysians are very clever. If we can find ways to export, we would have done it. So one of the small exporters we have been talking to, she's a Bumi Putra exporter, and she exports a lot of snacks. She's very successful to the Middle East, and she looks at all the different markets, halal market, etc. So we asked her, will the CPTPP help you? She said, look, I am a successful exporter today because I learn about the markets. I learn about their non-tariff measures that they require, hygiene, packaging, this and that. If I know that, then I can actually try to export. Tariffs for her wasn't an issue because there were no tariff barriers.
Okay, right? All right. So you're saying, there was nothing stopping them from, entrepreneurs from going into these markets. How would the CPTPP help push it forward? I do take your point for that. I do want to ask you about the mention of liberalization. There are those who say, they argue that greater liberalization of trade and provisions in the CPTPP will help Malaysia address some of the issues of poor governance, of corruption, of abuse of power, especially because there are, as you mentioned, issues of the government procurement, for instance. There will be more transparency, more accountability. Do you see the merit in that argument?
I think it's very confusing, the analysis, right? If we suddenly bring in things like that. Now, we all want to have good governance, right? We want transparency. And I think we have come a long way. If you look at our government procurement rules today, right, compared to what it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, much, much more transparent. And of course, there are problems. Let's be very clear. This problem with corruption is not just peculiar to Malaysia. You have it in the United States. You have it across Europe, okay? So the governance fight and accountability fight is a democratic issue that we have to fight for at the national level all the time. These trade agreements, let's be under no illusion, they are about liberalizing your economy and removing as much barriers as possible for big companies to come in, right? So if you look at liberalization of trade, we just talked about it. We will import more than we will export. That's actually, even the PwC study that was commissioned by MITI acknowledges that, right? Secondly, if you look at things like government procurement, right now we can choose to open up, right? We have 100% policy space. We can choose to open up any procurement tender to anybody in the world. All we can say, and this is actually where we want to give preferences to Malaysian companies, or maybe within Malaysia, we want to give it to, Bumi Putra or maybe Sabah Sarawak. So that kind of flexibility for you to direct government procurement as a tool to make sure your domestic companies get the contracts, build the capacity to manufacture, to do servicing, etc., is very important. We're not saying you don't open up, but open up in a way that you can control as a sovereign country. Under this agreement, we have agreed, not we, the government of the day, whatever, has agreed to actually open up government procurement quite extensively beyond what we've ever done. Unilateral opening can always move back and forth. With this kind of agreements, once you open up, there's no going backwards. There are some carve-outs. I'm not saying they're not, but they're not enough compared to, it's like saying, I have 40% of freedom left when I had 100% freedom before, right? And I think the other point is really crucial, and there's been a lot of confusion created. Oh, don't worry, foreign investors will not be able to sue Malaysian government. All
right? Yeah, this is the investor
state. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so it is a very controversial right to give to private investors, you know, and it's become a big debate across the world. Right. So in the original Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that was led by the US, there was in the investment chapter, they created this investment investor state dispute settlement, right, for foreign investors to sue a government on different grounds. And this was very controversial. And interestingly enough, the US, you know, under Obama really led, you know, this agreement originally. The Trump administration walked out. And one of the reasons they walked out was because they said that we do not want foreign companies in the United States investing in the US to be suing the US government. There were many things that the Trump people were not happy about, but ISDS, as it's called, was one of the biggest reasons. Biden comes back. Biden has not come back to the disagreement, right? They suspended two categories, like investment contracts. If you don't, you know, if your government signs a contract with a foreign investor, so they have actually suspended two categories. But a third category remains in the CPTPP, in the investment chapter. So there is still exposure to being sued by an investor.
Well, if I may, just to counter that point, in some of my interviews about the CPTPP, and this I remember from the former deputy MITI minister, Ong Kian Ming, he said that this was a year ago, I think, the ISDS, the fear around the ISDS is actually quite overblown, if I may paraphrase him, that foreign investors are looking to do business in Malaysia for the long term may not be so quick to sue the government of the market that they are keen to operate in. Is that okay?
I think it's certainly, I mean, this is why you have to also, and Malaysia, frankly, in our early years of successful, you know, investment, you know, drawing investors, we actually had a very sophisticated policy, right? Which sectors you want to allow foreigners to come? How do you want to make sure that the foreign investment is linked to developing your local capability? So we require, for example, foreign investors to buy a certain amount of their, let's say, supplies from local suppliers, or you have to put, you know, senior people into your management eventually, so we can train up people to be leading companies and banks, right? Or you will say that you have to, you know, so that what we call, you know, conditions on the foreign investment. Now, this is actually a way to manage foreign investment so that they can actually fit into your country. At the same time, they make profit. So you pick and choose the kind of investments, the kind of investors. So that's, we are totally in support of that. And we have been successful in that. But under this agreement, all those conditions about trying to or transfer technology, you know, teach our local people, you know, link to local suppliers, all those requirements, you cannot put them into your conditions for foreign investors coming into the country anymore. That's number one, okay? And secondly, about being overblown, you know, we in the past, we have signed also investment agreements, but the scope of the investment that's protected is much narrower compared to what we see in the CPTPP. So the one big ground or reason when an investor wants to sue you is what we call the investor has a right to fair and equitable treatment, which sounds nice. But if you look at what that means in practice, in cases of ISDS that have gone on for many years, it's really about how if investors were to lose profit, including projected future profits, because government regulations have come in on health or environment, et cetera. You can do health and environmental actions, but if you cause the loss of profit, including future profit, that is a ground to take you to court. Now, I'm not saying every investor is going to sue us, right? But once you liberalize, you don't control who comes in anymore that much. And then you find down the line, you will get sued. You go to the United Nations UNCTAD website. They have a whole website on all the cases, mining companies. We had also cases where labor laws and minimum wages were challenged, you know. And you know what? Among the different countries, Japan is one of those that use ISDS quite a lot, Japanese companies. All right.
Okay. All right. Okay. So we have a couple of minutes left. I do want to very quickly ask you, is this a one-way track? I mean, is withdrawal from the CPTPP still possible at this juncture?
Yeah, well, you know, within the CPTPP, there is a provision that any party can withdraw. You have to give 6 months' notice. All right. Our concern was that, you know, there was a promise from the former MITI minister, right, that the latest CBA would be taken to Parliament. There'll be more public discussion. And without that happening, and that CBA itself acknowledges a number of issues that are problematic, how do you decide it, that the benefits outweigh the cost? Then you find that there are many assumptions in the modeling that's used. And they were very upfront about the limitations of their modeling, right? So I think we cannot pick and choose from a CBA and then say, you know, and of course, the whole ratification was done days before Parliament was dissolved. There were many questions from MPs already submitted, and they were going to ask questions about the CBA. About
it wasn't balancing. It wasn't debated in Parliament.
No,
right?
No, because we dissolved Parliament and went into elections. So now we have a whole new government, which has, and the other thing is, a lot of the assumptions in the CBA is that the world remains unchanged, right? No more new pandemic, no more crisis. You assume many things. And you also assume that there's full employment in the country with all those numbers that they have crunched. So these are assumptions which are not real. They say we are modeling. This is actually not actually the reality. Now, okay, that's how modeling is done. But how can the government, the last government, with its instability, dissolve parliament? So that's why we, in a big coalition, called for, you know, before the 60 days was up, let's withdraw while it's still at that stage and come and reconsider in the light of the new policies the new government may want to put into place to make ourselves stronger. In the end, you know, if you explain, you know, foreign investors are not going to run away, because as long as we are attractive in many other factors, impact on why a foreign investor comes into your country, just a trade agreement.
But those 2 months are up now.
Yeah, so what we want, we will continue our campaign. In fact, tomorrow we're going to have a forum. We're going to explain, Malaysians, please wake up. This is what it means. And we are not being ideological. We are saying, look at the pros and cons. Let's look at the details, right? It is comprehensive, very, very comprehensive, right? Tenaga Nasional, Petronas, they're all going to be affected. What does this mean for our country? And okay, we need to find out. So we will continue our campaign. We will ask the government to withdraw, not too late. And if you want to sign agreements, go very carefully, know what you want to sign, and let's have public discussion. Because in the end, that's where the real democracy will lie, that we all have a right to know.
Thank you so much for speaking with me, Chee Yok Ling from Third World Network. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. We're discussing the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the CPTPP. It's now come into effect some 2 months after the previous government had submitted to ratify the trade agreement. All of this is happening amid a petition calling for Malaysia to pull out of the deal and to postpone ratification pending Parliament consideration, a Parliament deliberation, and more stakeholder consultation. I've got my next guest joining me on the line, Dr. Juwita Mohamad. She's the Director of Research and the Director of Economics and Business and the Business Unit for Ideas Malaysia. The think tank has long advocated for the ratification of the CPTPP. Juwita, thank you for joining me on the show. Can I ask you what you made of those calls to pull out from the agreement? There's this collective that's objecting to the ratification. They say they are concerned about more research and consultation that needs to be done first. The issues have not been debated in Parliament, that business and consumers have not been educated on the far-reaching implications from the CPTPP. How do you respond to some of these concerns? What are the benefits you see from ratifying with this agreement?
Thank you, Melissa, for that very important question. First, we need to look at the benefits as well as some challenges that we see in the road to being a part of CPTPP after ratification. So again, obviously, ideas at ideas, we welcome the ratification, and now we have entered into force after 8 years of negotiations. And we do note that ratifying the CPTPP as a whole will help to boost trade activities and also economic growth, especially in the backdrop of economic recovery from the pandemic, as well as the looming global economic downturn as early as next year. So looking at the numbers, we do see that the member countries of the CPTPP collectively comprised of 13% of global GDP. And again, we look forward to it giving the benefits of a non-traditional free trade agreement, because again, CPTPP goes beyond providing market access for goods, services, and investments. It also provides high quality standards on issues related to state-owned enterprises, public procurement, the environment, and also on labor issues as well. In a nutshell, let me just try to explain and also try to share with you the estimates of gains to be reaped in the medium term. So we have estimated that implementing the CPTPP would boost Malaysia's GDP by an additional 1%. Again, this is driven by an expansion in trade in itself in the medium term. And when we look at new employment opportunities, this would come up to about 140,000 additional work or vacancies. Yes. So coming back to the question, had enough research or consultation been done before, my answer would be yes. Various publications and impact assessment studies have been done during the original TPP negotiations, as well as the CPTPP ratification process. And these are also supported by town hall sessions, which were held during those times as well. Just to highlight to everyone, for the original TPP, a national interest analysis was published by ISIS, looking at the economic, social, and also security pillars when it comes to ratifying the TPP itself. And at the same time, PwC also underwent a quantitative analysis using the GTAP model, looking at the quantifiable welfare gains in the medium to long term.
Juita, if I may just interrupt you there, I do want to ask you. So you're saying that there's been research done, there's been consultation done, and in any agreement, there are opportunities and there are trade-offs. What is needed to bridge the skeptics, to reach out to the skeptics? If this is something the government has decided, or the previous government has decided to do, and has essentially committed Malaysia, because now the agreement is in force, what is needed then to get the buy-in of the skeptics, the public, the people who argue that this is to the detriment of consumers and to small businesses?
So, of course, the public needs to be aware of such developments. And I feel that healthy public discourse on the matter should take place respectfully between different stakeholders. So at IDEAS, we agree that while the ratification of the agreement marks an important milestone, the job is not done. We need to have a continuous assessment on the impact of the CPTPP on the ground. These assessment analysis needs to take place within the country and also with the other CPTPP member countries as well. There also needs to be additional support for MSMEs, especially to be included in the CPTPP supply chain, and also to enhance their competitiveness so that they can effectively participate in the supply chain. So as the CPTPP is again a comprehensive partnership, after every 3 years or so, there will be an update and an upgrade and a review of those clauses. So the first stage or the first part of the review has already taken place after 3 years of ratification and entry into force. So again, this is an ongoing free trade agreement that can be shaped by member countries continuously.
Okay. What are the lessons that we can take from other member states who have implemented have ratified and enforced the CPTPP? I understand we are the ninth member state to do so. What can we learn, particularly when it comes to very contentious issues like the investor-state dispute mechanism, settlement mechanism?
I'm glad you asked this question, Melissa, because during the review of the CPTPP, which pulled in various think tanks from all of the CPTPP member countries, this was exactly what was talked about. So for the case of Malaysia, the contentious areas would be on labor empowerment and as well on the state-owned enterprises and government procurement issues. So this is, again, something that the group is very aware of. And for now, the analysis is still at a quantitative level. When we have more data, when we enter into force for a longer time period, when data is available, then we can look at the qualitative aspects of the impact of those clauses on the Malaysian economy as well.
Okay, so I guess we will be checking back in to make sure that everything is on track and to see what kind of progress is happening with the CPTPP. Thank you so much, Dr. Juta, for joining me on the show today. Dr. Juta Mohamad from Ideas Malaysia, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.